to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
John's going to talk for 10, 15 minutes, something like that, and give an overview of a long, complex work and tell us everything we need to know about it in 10 or 15 minutes, because authors love doing that. And then I'm going to ask some questions, and then you're going to ask the rest of the questions. So why don't we begin? I'll go down here, and John, why don't you tell us about the book?
I am not going to try to summarize the book in 10 to 15 minutes. I thought what I would do is, in fact, just to spur some discussion, really just focus on trying to present some provocative propositions to provoke everybody and hopefully get disagreement and get some debate going. So I'll just go through a series of provocative propositions that are in the book. I won't seek to support them with much evidence. Trust me, there is more evidence in the book, but I'll throw in a tidbit here and there in terms of support. So the first provocative proposition that I would offer is that our basic management approaches and institutions are fundamentally broken. And so I think that's a pretty basic observation and is a theme that runs throughout the book. So if you don't buy into that, you're probably not going to buy into the rest of the book. The one piece of evidence that I'll cite here to support that rather broad statement is some work we did actually that was published in what we called the Shift Index last year. And it was basically an attempt to look at long-term trends in the US economy and how the business landscape is changing around us. One of the metrics, we had 25 metrics in the index, one of the metrics kind of got all the attention of the executives we deal with and the public policy folks, and it was a metric that looked at profitability for all public companies in the United States since 1965. We didn't take a sample, we looked at every single public company, and we looked at return on assets as the basic measure of profitability. Over that time period, return on assets has basically collapsed. Since 1965, return on assets has declined by 75%. It is a significant and sustained trend. There is no evidence of it leveling off, much less turning around. In executive boardrooms that I deal with, I often hear the metaphor, the image of the Red Queen. We run faster and faster to stay in the same place. What we're seeing in the US economy is something quite different and even worse than the Red Queen. We're running faster and faster and falling farther and farther behind. So I would suggest that that is perhaps evidence that something is fundamentally broken. This has been such a consistent trend over such a long period of time that it's worth stepping back and asking, why is this happening? The second proposition I would offer is that basically it's not about intensifying competition, although that's certainly an element of it. It is, in our view, that competition, the basis of competition, is fundamentally changing. It's not just getting harder, it's different, both in terms of the source of value creation and the means of value creation. So in terms of the source of value creation, we have a key proposition that value creation in the past century in the US economy was around knowledge stocks. If you were able to get proprietary knowledge stocks and were able to protect that knowledge stock and then as efficiently as possible extract the value from it, you would make a fortune. In fact, fortunes were made around this proposition. All the major companies that emerged in the 20th century held that basic view. We would argue that given the changes that are going on at a fundamental level in the economy, if all you do is protect knowledge stocks, you're in a losing game because knowledge stocks are depreciating in value at an accelerating rate, with the possible exception of Coca-Cola's secret formula for their favorite soft drink. But in general, if you look at product life cycles compressing, any proprietary knowledge you have around a particular product, shorter and shorter time period to extract the value from it. So the proposition is that we're moving to a world where the source of economic value becomes knowledge flows. It's about how do you participate in more diverse and relevant knowledge flows to refresh your knowledge stocks. And the companies who do that most effectively will be the ones to win. And I would suggest that it also applies to us at the individual level, not just at the company level. It's about knowledge flows. Are you in the flow? This related proposition, and it's kind of the core theme of the book, is this notion that the means of value creation is shifting from what we call push to pull. Push models basically drive off the assumption that you can predict and forecast demand. Based on that prediction and forecast, you make sure that all the resources and people are in the right place at the right time to meet that demand. Worked miracles in the 20th century. Again, great fortunes were created around push models of economic value creation. We suggest that because of the increasing uncertainty and change in the world, that model is increasingly challenged, and that the real power now in terms of creating economic value has to do with mastering techniques of pull. Very different set of approaches, and we develop in some detail the elements of pull that we think are going to become more and more important. So another question, so that I think that answers the question of one mystery is, if you believe in markets, and I certainly do, why has this continued deterioration in profitability occurred over such a long period? Surely, with innovation in the economy, we would have figured out how to cope with the new world that's around us. Why are we continuing down this long slide? And I would suggest it is because these basic assumptions about where and how value gets created are very deeply held. The mindsets that we bring to our business in terms of assumptions for what you need to do to be successful are still held very tightly by most senior executives. So if we need innovation to change this worrisome trend, I'll lead to another provocative proposition, which is that the Center for Innovation on a global basis is shifting from the United States to China and India. And to support that proposition, I'll first redefine what I think most of you would immediately associate with innovation, because my experience is most Western executives would say that innovation is about breakthrough product or technology innovation. It's all about the product and technology, and it's really about breakthrough. Don't bother me if you're talking about this incremental stuff. That's the narrow definition of innovation. We've broadened it over time to say process innovation is important. Gary Hamel has said now that management innovation is important, by which he means the management approach within an enterprise. We go one step further and say the most valuable innovation going forward is what we call institutional innovation. It has to do with rethinking at a fundamental level the rationale, the roles, and relationships across many independent entities, many independent enterprises. Now, if you take our definition of institutional innovation and look for where that's occurring today, it's occurring. The most sophisticated examples that we've been able to find are actually in China and India. And they're occurring in a very broad array of industries, everything from motorcycles to apparel to financial services to agricultural products. It's a very diverse set of industries, so it gives us some confidence that what's going on over there is broadly applicable. It's not just restricted to one or two industries. And this innovation is basically invisible to Western executives. Most Western executives have no idea what's going on because they are looking for innovation in a very narrow frame. It's about product and technology innovation and breakthroughs. So if I don't see any breakthrough product or technology innovation going on, not to worry. There's no innovation. It's a very different form of innovation. So, if I haven't provoked enough, let me go to another one, which is that for the first time, I would argue, and we argue in the book, that we have an opportunity to move from a diminishing returns business landscape to an increasing returns business landscape. What do I mean by that? I'll reveal my age by saying that I was actually started my career at Boston Consulting Group many, many years ago when they pioneered a key concept. It was called the experience curve. It was a very powerful concept. It described how performance improved in industry after industry. They started with semiconductors. They demonstrated it in everything from toilet paper to Japanese beer. It had a very consistent pattern. It was a diminishing returns pattern. The more experience you accumulated, the longer you had to wait for the next increment of performance improvement. We believe that for the first time, again, because of a set of technology infrastructures that are emerging and because of a set of management practices and institutional innovation, we for the first time have an opportunity to take to move to an increasing returns performance improvement curve. Where do we find evidence for that? This is probably the most speculative part of our book. We actually look very far afield. We look at things like extreme sports. We spend a lot of time looking at big wave surfing in particular. We go online gaming to World of Warcraft, and then we look at a whole series of initiatives in the open source software arena and related areas. And again, just to be provocative, I will make the assertion without support at this point. I'll support it very briefly if I'm allowed with a quick story. That the one of the most powerful and fruitful places for management education today is World of Warcraft. It's not Harvard Business School, with apologies to my alma mater. World of Warcraft. And I'll just tell you a quick story. I met a guy 10 years ago. I was in a startup in Silicon Valley. He was just out of college. And he was basically the computer help desk person for our startup. He was the guy you went to. He was a computer geek, he loved computers, and very helpful. 10 years later, he was just named CIO of Starbucks. He's the youngest CIO of any Fortune 500 company. Remarkable rise in 10 years. Basically, if you ask him the reason for his success and the rapid rise, it's because he was a guild leader in World of Warcraft, and he learned a set of management techniques that have been extraordinarily powerful in helping him to succeed and have impact in corporate environments. So then I'll just wrap with one final proposition, which is that if we're going to get to these increasing returns performance curves, we need to resolve something that we describe as the Dilbert paradox. I love paradoxes, by the way, hence the name of my research center called the Center for the Edge. The Dilbert paradox is this. If you go to any senior executive of any major US Western company and ask them what their top priorities are, inevitably, if it's not the top priority, it's within the top three, the priority is around talent. Got it? Talent's our most important priority. If that's the case, how do we explain the incredible popularity of these popular culture artifacts like Dilbert and The Office, that describe in such compelling terms the stultifying effect on talent of our average work environment? How do we resolve that? I would suggest that part of the resolution has to do with a further question you could ask that senior executive, which is, okay, so talent's your most important priority. What are you doing to foster that or to promote that? And they'll say, largely, broad generalization, but to be provocative, they will say two things. One is we're focused on attracting world-class talent wherever it is. We invest a huge amount in recruiting and getting the best people into this firm. And then on the other side, we're focused on retaining that talent. If there's any evidence that they're going to leave, we basically will do everything we can to hold them into our company. Really powerful. I would suggest they're missing the key element around talent, which is that middle element of talent development. And that if you were really focused on talent development and became the best place to develop talent, you would attract all the talent you could possibly handle. Word of mouth would spread that this is the place to go. And you would hold on to that talent as long as you could, because why would they ever leave? If they're developing more rapidly as part of your firm or institution, why would they ever leave? So with that, maybe I'll just... Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was provocative.
Thank you.
So we now seven provocations. But I actually want to step back from the provocations for a moment,
okay.
And we'll see who is provoked about what.
Yeah.
And ask you, I want to try to get a sense of the overall, because you've alluded to various elements of your world,
yeah.
You know, your worldview, how things fit together. So we have the shift index,
yes.
Going back to 1965, and the historical view of business. We have the big shift, which figures prominently in the book and is related to the shift index.
Yes.
And we have pull.
Yeah.
So I'm. Can you...
make sense out of all that.
Well, sure, yeah. what's the constellation? What's the worldview in which these things play?
It's a good question. There is a basic structure to the book in the sense that part of it is a descriptive exercise. We believe and we try to support the proposition that we are in the middle of a big shift that is occurring, not just in the US, but globally. And so we try to describe what are the deep forces that are driving this big shift. And that's the shift index was our attempt to quantify key dimensions of that big shift and really, again, in a descriptive frame, really develop insight around what's going on in the world around us. Go beneath the surface events, go beyond the immediate events that we all tend to focus on, the newspaper headlines, and go long-term, deep, and try to figure out what's going on. So that's the opening part of the book. I'd say the bulk of the book is really what we would call prescriptive. It's trying to answer the question, so what do you do about it? You know, we may all understand there's a big shift out there, so what are the implications for change? And in that case, we basically organize largely around the theme of pull. We describe three levels of pull that are becoming more and more central to success. And we talk about it in a variety of contexts. And then what we do is, on a prescriptive note again, is we take three different levels of application. We say there is a way, an opportunity for all of us as individuals to apply the techniques of pull in our personal and professional lives. So what would that look like? And how do you make the start down a migration path from where you are today to where you need to be in this world of pull? And then we do it again for institutions. And we say, for institutions, what are the implications? How would you think about a migration path to get from here to there? And then in probably our most ambitious effort, we take a focus on what we would describe as arenas, because we believe you can use the power of pull to basically reshape entire markets, industries, social arenas using these techniques. So you're not just moving an institution, you're moving a whole set of institutions in fundamental ways.
So, first of all, can people hear John? Because we made what may be a tragic decision about microphones.
Dampening the...
So you're okay in the back. Okay. And if not, you could move forward. You all the way in the back. Okay, so since... this is nominally a Berkman Center for Internet and Society meeting. Let me ask at least one internet question, which is, to what extent does the big shift correlate to the rise of the net?
Yeah.
Or what role does the net play? Is it the both, first of all, and then I think what may be related to that is, perhaps, why the word pull? Can you say more about what pull as a metaphor does, why it works in this description?
Yeah.
Because you use a variety of other metaphors. You've already used the edge, which figures very prominently in,
yeah.
Not only in your online presence, but also in the book. You frequent references to the edge and the center and the,
yeah.
And presumably when I was reading, I thought, oh, well, they could have called it the edge,
right.
You know. As well as the pull. So can you say more about the internet and pull?
The internet and pull. The internet, not surprisingly, we would argue is actually central to what's going on. We, in the shift index and the big shift work we did, the descriptive side, we essentially ended up focusing on two key forces that are shaping this entire world economy. One of them is what we would describe as digital technology infrastructure, internet. And the key building blocks around computing, storage, and bandwidth. And what's particularly interesting to us in that context is, unlike any other historical infrastructure, and here we draw heavily on the work of a woman by the name of Carlotta Perez, if any of you know her, remarkable book on tracing out the patterns around deployment of infrastructures having to do with electricity, the automobile, a whole set of major technology innovations. What the pattern in all of those was that you had a burst of innovation. And then, in a relatively short period of time, the core technology stabilized. You know, there's, you know, peripheral marginal improvement in price performance, but basically you had the element in place and relatively stable. And so a whole other set of people could come in and then innovate around the infrastructure. How do you deliver that technology to the rest of the world? And lo and behold, after a burst of innovation around that, that stabilized. And then you had an opportunity for the rest of the world to figure out what to do with all this infrastructure.
We did get fax machines, so clearly there's still plenty of innovation in the telephone system,
yes,
for example.
Yes, yeah. No, for sure. I mean, again, this is, I'm generalizing at a very high level.
Please continue.
So, but what's different here is all the core technology components, these three elements, computing, storage, and bandwidth, are continuing to increase at exponential rates in terms of price performance. There's no evidence of it slowing down, at least in the near term. Eventually, exponential rates can't continue forever, but for the foreseeable future, we're facing a set of technologies that are driving exponential improvement. We are, in turn, seeing entire infrastructures being redefined. Right now, the key buzzword in the tech world is cloud computing. There are more words spilled around cloud computing than if you actually look at how many people are actually using cloud computing. It's a tiny fraction. I think you have to round up to 1 or 2%. And so in that context, we've got a whole way to go in terms of the adoption of cloud computing and rethinking based on cloud computing what we would do. And I guarantee that's not the end of the infrastructure innovations that we're going to see. So internet key, and from an economic viewpoint, the key impact of digital technology infrastructure is to systematically reduce barriers to entry and barriers to movement on a global scale. And in economic terms, that means intensifying competition, which means greater economic pressure, which sets into motion this erosion in profitability. So the second question?
Pull.
Why did we pick pull? Well, the reason we didn't pick edge, although we love the term, we've adopted it as our name, is because it's a descriptive term. It basically is very effective in describing elements that are out there, but it's not very prescriptive in terms of, okay, so what do you do about it? We were looking to really focus on the prescriptive side, and we felt that pull was a very interesting kind of opposite to the conventional approach to organizing institutions and managing resources.
So let me ask you a question that actually reflects my own fears, not actually your book. That's sort of great interview questions. Here's what I'm worried about. Much of what's written about the internet, and especially the stuff that glorifies it, which is something, you know, I spend a fair bit of my time doing, so.
Very eloquently.
Well, thank you. Looks at the best examples. But the best examples, excuse me, are frequently atypical examples. That's what makes them the best examples. So in the writing about the how wonderfully the net responded to the volcanic ash plume, people with lots of Twitter followers posted very happy reports about how well Twitter functioned. You know, systems, all traditional institutions failed, Twitter worked. So Twitter worked really well. So I want to make an exception to this in a second, but Twitter worked really well if you had thousands of followers and you could say, anybody have a place I can stay in London? And yeah, there were. But if you were more typical, if you had sort of long tail of Twitter, then a lot of those services would not have worked. Now the exception, which I'll put in parentheses, is the use of hashtags actually allows the long tail to participate. Yes. Nevertheless, the people who were exulting over the internet's capability seemed to me to be the special cases. And in the same way, because you're writing a book and you're an author and you're, many of the examples that you pick and which you talk about at some length and in a sort of narrative style, very engaging narrative style, you're telling their stories, are people who are at the extreme head. It's Joey Ito. Right? And many of us are familiar with Joey Ito and and he is a person who literally, just about literally, lives on planes and does wonderful work, but he's, you know, he's Joey Ito, and he's very well known. Or the surfing example is
Dusty Payne.
Yeah, who apparently is a big name. I don't follow this
very
closely.
Dusty Payne is a very big name if you follow big wave surfing.
So here's a case of somebody who did the pull thing and succeeded, but he's Dusty Payne. He's the Joey Ito of surfing, which he's probably never been called before. But you know, it's so, to what extent are you concerned that the picture that we have of the internet's effect is, and the role that it plays in pull as well, depends upon looking at the special cases, which may turn out to be so special that they're not typical of the phenomenon?
No, it's a great question. I think that it reflects our whole technique, so we are potentially at risk, not just in the book, but in all the research we do, because the research approach we take, our charter was to identify emerging business opportunities that are not on the CEO's agenda and do the original research required to be persuasive why it should be on the agenda. And given that charter, you can't do rigorous statistical analysis of large databases because these are emerging opportunities. There aren't a lot of examples. And what you have to do is find those extreme examples, those best examples, and look for patterns across them to say, I mean, one question is, are these just individuals who have unique circumstances and there's nothing comparable? One of our exercises is to say, what is consistent across all those? Are there patterns that we can look to say maybe this isn't just the individuals? But at the end of the day, it is a challenge to say with confidence this will prevail throughout the entire world. I think what we have to do again is go back to the deep forces and say, are these individuals doing things that actually demonstrate the power of what you could do, and that the word will spread and other people will engage? The other thing which you didn't really ask about is obviously there's a dark side to the internet. People are using the internet for horrible things. Sorry.
Shh.
I didn't get my communique.
Go ahead. Fine. Blab it.
No. It's definitely the case. And we certainly haven't spent a lot of time in the power of pull talking about that. Our belief is that there's an inevitable lag time between the advent of new technologies and the social practices that evolve around those technologies, and we're still at the early stages of figuring out what to do with all this stuff, and we'll become a lot smarter, we'll become a lot more effective in dealing with the dark side in terms of, you know, coping with those uses, although inevitably any technology ends up having a dark side. So,
well, I was going to ask one more question, but I'm going to ask two more.
One
of the oft-noticed problems with an internet such as the one that we have, in which pull, in a particular sense, is a dominant way in which people gather attention, is that, you know, not only is there a certain type of obnoxious behavior that will gather attention, but it's all shy people may not do very well. Mm. It's not because they're not, you know, worthy, but they're just sort of shy on the internet. So this is actually, will lead into the next question, but is that one of the concerns that you have, that in this restructuring, this big shift, shifting power, it's getting more distributed, but it's getting distributed to certain personality types that don't have the merit necessarily that we, it's not the meritocracy that we would all like?
It's again a great question, and probably a longer answer than merited. My quick answer would be that I don't believe that's the case, for a couple of reasons. One is, I think that to us at least, when we put a lot of emphasis on this, and I can go into the reasons if you want, but that this is the power of pull and the power of the internet has ultimately to do with the ability to build long-term trust-based relationships in a much more scalable way than you ever could in the past. The kind of personality that's just out there for the quick dollar and the very transactional kind of personality or mindset won't last very long, or they'll have a burst and then they'll go out. The people who will create the most value, our belief is, are those who figure out how to use this to build long-term trust-based relationships. second issue, and I'll use it as a hook to just bring in one of my favorite topics in the book, which is the increasing importance of passion. And for a variety of reasons, we make a very strong case that passion is becoming more and more central to economic success. But one of the things that passion does on a personal level is it helps that shy person to overcome their inhibitions. And I will say, I actually speak from personal experience. As a child, I was extraordinarily introverted and shy. I had a very hard time connecting. My way out of that was by writing. Initially, pre-internet, writing books. And it was an opportunity for me to connect with people, to communicate to people, without having to do the face-to-face kind of interaction. And the response I would get from that writing actually reinforced that maybe I had something worth saying, and maybe I was, should make more effort to connect at the personal level. I think on the internet we're seeing a lot of that. Very shy people in their personal lives actually becoming really great bloggers, really great Twitterers and Facebook people, and because they have passion and they're reaching out and speaking from the heart about their passion. They're authentic. They're not there just to, make the quick buck. They're really deeply engaged around a particular theme or topic.
So I maybe should have qualified shy by saying internet shy, because there are people shy in the real world through Blossom and vice versa.
Right. No, absolutely.
So I wonder whether you are underestimating the enormous power of shyness, even in the face of passion. But
maybe.
So one of the things that's really interesting about the book, The Power of Pull, should hold it up to the camera, is that it talks in a structured and organized way from the personal to the largest institutional. Right? And it's in some ways it's a theory of everything, which you don't see all that often. So I want to ask you about the institutional, and then I'll stop, which you did was one of your provocations. And I wonder how radical a change in not the way institutions work and how they're managed, but in their very nature you foresee, and the extent to which, you write about leadership, very interesting in this. These are all reasons why both William Jefferson Clinton and Newt Gingrich blurbed you. Did Clinton insist on being called William Jefferson Clinton instead of Bill Clinton?
No, okay, that was our publisher.
Anyway, that's not the question I was going to ask.
I think it's the first book, by the way, to have been endorsed by both of these august individuals.
So you talk about leadership, and in the back of my mind, I'll tell you honestly as a friend, in the back of my mind I was thinking, they're talking about leadership to business leaders in this book and sort of holding back the thought that, the very nature of leadership is eroding and the corner office and the whole deal just may not be exactly where you're going to be in 10, 15, 20 years when the big shift works through. To what extent do you see institutions fundamentally changing their nature and thus the nature of leadership of those institutions changing as well?
To be clear, I mean, we would argue that institutions will change at the most basic level, even the rationale. What's the rationale? I mean, somebody won the Nobel Prize in economics by saying that the rationale for firms was around reducing transaction costs. Absolutely, Ronald Coase. And that was a very great description of the firms, again, of the 20th century. And it was the rationale, and I believe all the structural and management practices derived from that basic insight. I would say that the rationale for an institution today is much more around talent development. If you cannot develop talent more rapidly than anybody else, you will lose.
But will there still be institutions of the sort that we have, but large corporations for example?
Well, again, a longer discussion. We have a point of view that this is not about everything fragmenting. It's not the Elance economy or the independent contractor economy in aggregate. We believe there will still be large institutions. There will be a lot more of the contractor and the Elance kind of activity. But if, to the extent there are large institutions, it's because they can demonstrate that scale actually provides more rapid talent development, particularly around the network of relationships that they can aggregate on behalf of their participants, and that those will still be a significant force in the economy. They'll be very different from what we have today.
So are you open to the argument? Of course, you're open to it, being an open-source guy, but are you open to the argument that, in fact, institutional forms of talent development are necessarily more limited and limiting than what one can get in an opener environment? That no institution is going to be sufficient for no institution will be able to develop talent as well as the non-institutional environment. For the same on the same grounds that Bill Joy said famously, the thing I don't remember.
More smart people outside your organization than inside.
Yes, and there are more mentors outside your organization than inside.
Yes, yes, absolutely. So a key part of our view is that the institutional architectures, if you will, of the future are going to be much more network-oriented. I don't mean internet-oriented, but business network-oriented in terms of connecting in very large, scalable networks of relationships. Specifically with the intent of connecting out to all those smart people and trying to build relationships with them where you both sides can learn faster as a result of that relationship. We have a belief that institutions could actually do that more effectively than any individual in their own right. And I should say, too, we're looking at a very different array of institutions. I mean, I believe an open source software initiative is an institutional arrangement. It's not your traditional firm, but it has a governance process and a set of protocols and everything else. So,
We'll start on that in that corner. We'll repeat question. Oh. He had the microphone, though.
We have a microphone here.
So we'll do the microphone thing, and if it gets in the way, we'll repeat questions instead. And why don't you stand by for the second question?
Wanted to follow up on that topic of institutions. I completely agree that they will be more networked, not just for resources, but for changing for cooperation in producing new products and also for producing new business models. Mm-hmm. I think some of the boundaries that I see in organizations, they can't survive unless they change the nature of the boundary with people next to them that maybe they've never paid attention to before. To what extent do you see evidence of that more networking and changing of what it means to network already occurring in industries around the world?
Well, I would say that it is occurring. Obviously, I'm looking at the best examples and trying to extrapolate from it, but we've actually spent, our research center has spent a lot of time in China and India looking at companies out there who are creating incredibly scalable networks on a global basis. I mean, one of the pushbacks we get when we talk about China and India is, they've got a very unique culture. It's culture-specific. You couldn't possibly do this in any other area. Many of these networks are truly global, and most of the participants are actually no longer Chinese at all. And so they've managed to demonstrate, I think, the ability to take these practices and apply them in very different cultures and societies. But it's a completely different way of thinking about the business. One of the key innovations that they have is a notion of redefining process management in modular, loosely coupled forms. So you're creating modules of activity, and you're focusing a lot of time on specifying the interfaces of those activities. And doing this, by the way, without technology. I mean, I'm not talking about technology. I'm talking about management practice. And one of our propositions is, imagine what would happen if you took those management practices, loosely coupled modular approaches, and combined them with loosely coupled modular technology architectures, which are now becoming available. What could you do then? That would be pretty powerful.
Okay. You are a medium, not a Okay. Thank you, John. Okay. And can we? I'm sorry. We should say who we are as well.
Okay. My name is Rick Burns. I work at a company called HubSpot in Kendall Square, and I wanted to ask a question about the return on assets that you were talking about at the beginning. So that's for big companies. Is it possible that there is a better return on assets for smaller companies, because a lot of the data, or I mean, a lot of the things you're talking about are potentially things that are more likely to happen in small companies?
Right. we are limited by the data. We, for pragmatic reasons, chose to look at just public companies. Although public companies of any size, not just big public companies, but any company that's publicly traded, is part of our database. We did do an analysis, because we got pushback on this, about size of company. Does ROA vary based on size of company? There is no meaningful pattern. The very largest public companies are under the same pressure as the very smallest public companies. Now, the argument still could be made that there's a whole private enterprise sector that's not publicly traded, still private, privately owned. And maybe there's huge innovation going on there, and their ROA is through the roof. I'm open to that argument. I'd like to see the data for it. I will say there is data showing that the rate of business failure among entrepreneurial ventures is increasing over time, which suggests that by the most basic measure of performance, survival, the private companies are not doing too well in aggregate.
But are there more being started? Is there more churn?
On percentage basis, not in absolute numbers, but percentage basis, there are more business failures in the privately owned company basis. So I'm sure there are more businesses being started.
Hi, thanks. Mark Tomizawa. Hi, David. Brookline guy and working on Civic Express. And this is going to sound odd, but if you take all the trends that Boston Consulting Group believes in, we're trying to prove that you could start a new enterprise almost overnight, zero time, zero resources that you own if you have a passionate crowd, and the crowd's big enough so you have all the intellectual property you have, and then you have access to all the resources because they're dormant, and people are going, what the hell? They're getting dusty. Let's try it. I'm wondering two things. I heard you talk about talent. What we're seeing is there's a lot of anti-talent behavior within organizations. As a friend put it, during a down economy, big organizations beat up on the talent. They go, well, where else are you going to go? And there's a massive shift once there's an economic recovery. What may make this one different is, as you fragment people from passion about their jobs, and you have the internet and anytime, anywhere productivity, the thing that comes together may actually be a new kind of stained glass window, for lack of a better term, mm-hmm. where people don't have to be in a place mm-hmm. at a specific time punching in.
Right.
And I'm wondering if it's massive freelancing, to take a media model,
right?
That if this, combined with what you talked about in China, loosely coupled,
yep.
might result in an incredibly flat production model where you almost have no company, you have a firm, you have three people who believe, and they broadcast what they want, and other people go, what the heck, I'm in, because right now I'm not happy. Mm-hmm. So you leveraging the negative feelings as well as the positive and the anytime, anywhere, in the loosely coupled model. So I know this is throwing a lot, but we're kind of working on that, and I'd love to stay in touch with you on this because I think we're all talking about the same diagonal. It's not flat. It's not vertical like an institution. Right. It's actually on the diagonal.
Right.
So just wondering.
A lot of questions embedded in that comment. I'll just focus on a few that came to mind. One is I agree completely. Most institutions, I think the Dilbert and Office representation of what goes on in most companies is dead on, and that's the reason people love it. It's talking about what happens to them on a daily basis. And just as one anecdote around this, I swear to God, I was at a conference in Silicon Valley, the center of talent, creative talent and passion, and there was a very senior executive of one of the largest technology companies in Silicon Valley, who I will refrain from naming, who described that they had really passionate people in their organization. And somebody asked him, and he said, we call them pizza people. And somebody raised the hand and said, well, why do you call them pizza people? And he said, well, because they're passionate, they're so passionate that we couldn't possibly bring them in front of an executive team, a senior executive team, because they're so unpredictable. They're loose cannons. You don't know what they would say or do in front of these executives. So we have to keep them behind locked doors in a separate area. And every once in a while, we'll slide a pizza underneath the door to keep them fed. So this is, you know, the heart of creativity and passion, speaking about how they treat passionate people in their organization. Yeah. So I think that that's a key red flag, that we're basically in a world that does not value passion. I would say, again, and I think there are valid reasons, most executives will say they want passionate workers. They're very sincere about that statement. What they mean is they want people who are passionate about doing the work that's assigned to them in a very predictable way. And the problem is that passion is inherently unpredictable. It leads off in all kinds of unexpected directions. And if you are in an institution that is driven by scalable efficiency and predictability, passion is an enemy.
Tom Peters used to tell a story, so this must be like in the 80s, right? Because he was all about the passion. And I think he may have been the first one to actually bring this
front and center.
To imagine that workers might actually be passionate about what they do. And I remember from one of his videos telling a story, I think it must have been about FedEx or UPS or one of those packages, about the guy who... It was supposed to get there that morning, and there was a snowstorm or whatever, and a guy rented a helicopter, and he flew it over the mountain and got it there. And that was an example of passion. I always thought about what the manager must have thought when the bill came.
Yeah.
It was an expensive...
What were you thinking?
It's $40,000. How much pizza would you have bought
for... I'm over budget now. I will also say one other trigger from your question was... When I talk about talent, I want to be really clear that I think, again, there are all kinds of patterns. I've dealt with senior executives for a long time. There is a clear pattern. When I talk about talent, they immediately go to knowledge workers, right? That's their talent. And in some cases, they actually don't even believe it's knowledge workers. They believe it's kind of the 100 high-potential people in their organization. That's really the talent to focus on. But I would argue that that's a false distinction. Any worker is working knowledge and has talent that can be used to deliver even more value to the marketplace. And one of our key problems is we have this segmentation. You know, if talent is all about knowledge workers, the rest of the workforce, they just do their job.
It's a skill-talent split, I think.
Yes. And. My colleague, John Seeley Brown, talks about the receptionist and the incredible creativity that an average receptionist has to show on a daily basis dealing with completely unexpected situations, that there are no policies and procedures to cope with. And you know, frontline workers on an assembly line, Toyota demonstrated that basically those routine workers could become incredibly passionate and creative.
Whereas traditionally the movement has been to de-skill, traditionally meaning since the 1900s.
Yes.
Has been to, and industrial age overall, but sort of systematic Taylorist de-skilling of workers was seen as the path to efficiency and return on assets.
Right.
Right. And you're telling us that's not right. that's not actually happening. Yeah.
Okay.
Well.
Justin Olson, two really quick questions. The first is just sort of a follow-up to the question that was asked earlier about the increasing rate of startup companies failing. Mm. And I would at least posit that with the bar being lowered for entry, that even with the increasing number, you would actually expect an increasing rate of failure.
Yeah.
So I don't know that there's necessarily any positive correlation between an increasing rate of failure and a decreasing rate of innovation. And the second question I wanted to ask is it possible that ROA might not be the right metric for sort of analyzing at least the return to society out of these companies, especially given that since 1970, give or take, almost every kind of technological base has been following Moore's Law fairly accurately and is increasing exponentially rather than giving a diminished rate of return. And I recognize that doesn't necessarily take into account investment and the return from investment necessarily, but overall, that those sectors at least are exponentially increasing. So.
Yeah. So the first question around the private sector and the privately owned companies and increasing failure rates, it is not an indication of return on assets for the entire private company sector. I will just say I'd like to see the data. I mean, I think we suffer in the privately owned company group from incredible opacity. There's no data. And we hear the success stories. We hear the ones that made it great. We never hear about the ones that are struggling just to make payroll. And I believe a return on assets analysis for private companies would probably show a significant deterioration in ROA over time. But I'd like to see data. I'd like to have it proven. I'm sorry, you asked the second question.
With respect to the tech companies following Moore's Law, transistors and almost anything internet related has been exponentially increasing. I'm just curious.
Well, tech companies have definitely benefited from. You also asked the social issue, and I want to be clear too. I was just talking about one metric in the shift index. Other metrics looked at, for example, benefits to consumers, and one element of the big shift is consumers are benefiting enormously. They're getting far more value at far lower prices than they've ever gotten before. So all of us, in one part of our lives, are hugely benefiting from this big shift. Second constituency we looked at was actually creative talent in companies. And we said, how is their total cash compensation changing over time? They have benefited enormously. By the way, the gap between so-called creative talent and the rest of the workforce has been widening in the process. But one way of thinking about the pressure on the corporation, and again, we're not saying this is society, we're saying this is one significant part of society, you can think about it as a pincer move on the corporation. On the one side, you've got more and more powerful customers who are demanding more value at lower price and getting it, and then you have creative talent that's got more and more bargaining power and central role to play in terms of value creation. They're getting more and more. The company's caught in the middle, being squeezed. So.
Thank you again for coming. My name is Ari. And many of the things that you said about talent and passion really struck a chord. And I was reading recently about teachers, and they said, "What do you value in students?" And this was early elementary education. They said, "Oh, creativity, independence, initiative, and stuff." And they found out that those were the students that they actually liked the least, and that they helped the least, and that they were pushing them away from those skills. They liked them to be creative when they were doing in art class on that project, and they liked them to have initiative and independence when they wanted them to get up to do stuff. But other than that, they weren't very interested, and that really struck a chord with how people want talent to work at their companies. They want to do their projects well.
Right.
And I've experienced that. I hope my bosses aren't watching, but I feel very much the same way. I was wondering, you talked, they should do this, and this is what, but I haven't actually heard about, like, what is my company to do? What if the CEO of my company says, well, we should really foster this, like, what is he going to do to make all the managers feel that way about talent at the company?
Great couple of questions. Your observation at first around schools, so I'll be, again, more provocative, and I'll state that from my experience and research, I believe, and apologies to the institution I'm sitting in, that the entire purpose of the educational system has been to squeeze out the passion that is naturally within us as we come into the school system. And it's done because corporations can't handle passionate people. And so they need to prepare people to go into the workforce and be productive. One of the things we're taught is if you insist on holding on to passion, you go to a job to get a paycheck so that you can pursue your passion outside of work, but don't bring it into the workforce, into the workplace, because that's bad. That's disruptive. That's not predictable. So, again, that's my provocation. And I'm sorry. The question after that, I get What do corporate leaders do about all this? Again, we have a whole part of the book which is really focused on what we call pulling from the top institutional leadership. And the challenge for institutional leaders in this emerging era is they cannot do it themselves. In the past, in a hierarchical command and control organization, you could mandate this is the way it's going to be done, and you got things done. So what we focus on in the book is a notion of the function of a leader is, first of all, to identify really central performance challenges that the company is facing, preferably on what we would describe as the edge of the company, not in the core. Don't try to change the core. Go out to the edge. These could be new business, new markets you're trying to go into, new products you're introducing, new sets of customers. But go to the edge with this aggressive performance challenge, and then put out a call to identify people who are really passionate about that performance.
Can you say what a performance challenge is?
Performance challenge could be, we're addressing, we're in this new market and we're experiencing nobody's buying the product. we actually believe it's a great product, and let's take for this case that it is a great product. Having a bunch of people to actually problem solve that and try to figure out, okay, where's the disconnect here? How could we actually increase the adoption of this product? But it's a notion of getting passionate people to surface, saying, putting out the challenge, because passionate people actually respond to challenges. They love challenges. They seek them out. And by the way, most passionate people in companies, if they're not, well, they're often well camouflaged, but if they're there, and they are there to some degree, they're typically on edges, because that's where they're least controlled by the core, and that's where there are the most interesting performance challenges. I mean, there's constant new reinvention that has to go on these edges. So they're all instinctively there. They're also risk takers, by the way, and so they're attracted again to edges. So the function of an executive, we believe, is to mobilize these people, get them to identify, help them to connect with each other, because often they don't know each other, and demonstrate performance impact on that edge, and then celebrate the hell out of it, and make it clear that the reason it was achieved was because of the passion of the people. And then don't dare pull those passionate people back into the core. Pull more people out to these edges. And over time, let the edge become the core, because you'll never transform the core. Provocative proposition.
Mal Watlington, City Square. First a comment, then a question. The comment about the edge seems, wow, here it comes again. I worked in manufacturing around 20, 25 years and found that the rate of innovation for any practice was inversely proportional to the proximity of the plant to headquarters. And so
I think that really bears out in your edge. The second one actually goes to other studies in your same area. You're probably familiar with the work of Mark Huselet, who for years has been gathering data on return against management practices.
I'm wondering if, in fact, your research has shown that there's a replacement of the practices that he'd been looking at for, say, 20-plus years. Mm. Is there a new set? Mm.
That's a great question. I hadn't really thought about it in those terms, but I think there is an interesting question of what kind of critical mass of these new practices do you need in order to turn this thing around? And in the meantime, as you're making transitions, do you suffer through the transition? Good question.
Sorry, didn't mean to preempt. My name is Andrew Maliazzi. I'm the founder of finalsclub.org, a nonprofit open education website. And actually, all this talk about institutional ROA and thought leadership makes me think of higher education as a place that has some particular problems with rising costs and sort of diminishing returns, I suppose. And I wonder how you think open education is changing that, and also how a social entrepreneur like myself might try to pull from the edges to change this institution in a positive way.
Right. I will say that education is not my particular specialty. I would urge you to connect with my colleague, John Seely Brown, who spent a lot of time looking at how to get change in educational institutions. I do think this whole notion of open education is a very powerful concept. Again, my particular bias, and it comes from working with companies, but I think John Seely Brown would share this, working with educational institutions, is don't go after the core. Find edges in terms of students who are not well served, new kinds of areas of learning that aren't effectively being addressed by educational institutions, and start to demonstrate impact in those areas. And over time, pull in more and more of the people from the traditional educational institutions into these alternative institutions.
How about down here?
She's been waiting.
Next.
You had mentioned that you have two political figures that blurbed on your book. Where do you think the edge is in our current political process?
God. Again, Paul.
that's certainly one sort of boundary.
Yeah. This is a whole other topic area, and I do have strong views on it. I'm reluctant to go down the path. I do think that I'll just say at the highest level that I believe government institutions, as much as companies, are push institutions, basically. Scalable efficiency was the way these institutions were defined, the way they grew, and I believe that model is increasingly challenged. I actually think some of the most interesting government initiatives are actually on edges, like Singapore, Dubai, very tiny entities that, again, almost by force have to figure out how to connect out in much more constructive ways and creative ways to broader sets of entities and participants. So I think that there's some interesting stuff going on at that level. I would say in public policy arena, Just a quick riff relative to what I was talking about, corporations and talent development. I think there's a very interesting exercise as we debate public policy options, which is to say very explicitly, how do we rate each of these public policy options in terms of their impact on talent development? Take that lens and say, what policy option would accelerate talent development? Which policy options would decrease it? And maybe we should be going for the ones that accelerate talent development. I think too often when we talk about talent development in a public policy context, we go to the educational system, which again, yes, that's critical to talent development, but I believe it's a provocative proposition becoming increasingly marginal to talent development. Most of the valuable learning that we have is in our day-to-day lives, as we go through our lives. What public policies would accelerate that, would enhance that, promote that? Might reframe the debates that we're having.
And one place where I think it actually has been pretty explicitly framed this way, which I assume would make you pretty happy, is in the broadband initiative.
Yes, yes, right. Some of the infrastructure.
Whether they're doing it the right way is a different question,
but
the notion that
yes,
this is why we want
absolutely
access.
So there's been some great pockets of innovation. One example has been Xerox in the 70s with amazing work, like Apple's Advanced Technology Group, you know, Atari, and a lot of these places did not have leaders with business school degrees. So my question is, do you think business schools are outdated, or are they causing harm, or are they just not, is what they're teaching just not relevant anymore?
Oh boy. Turn the video off.
Okay, thank you all for coming.
I will say that business schools, like companies, are struggling to catch up, to understand the nature of these fundamental changes that are playing out, and to restructure how they approach education and learning given those kinds of changes. So I do think there's a lot of opportunity and challenge. I would say in aggregate, I think degrees and credentials are going to diminish in importance. And in that context, I just can't resist another little story, which is told by Chris Anderson, who is the editor of Wired magazine. On his side, he has a real passion, which is around drone aircraft. And he's actually created a startup for open source drone aircraft. And he's very excited about it, but he got more and more insecure as he got into the thing because he has no technology background himself, a liberal arts guy. And so he said, I need a CTO for my startup if it's going to be successful. And so he went on a systematic search of all the logical targets, MIT, Carnegie Mellon, all the usual places, to find the CTO. And he was very disappointed. He just didn't find anybody who was really at the leading edge of what he was trying to do. And so one day he was on a chat forum, a discussion forum, of people who were into drone aircraft technology. And he struck up a conversation with this guy he'd never met before. And the more they talked, the more they interacted, he said, my God, this guy really understands this stuff, you know, way ahead of anybody else. And so he asked him, well, where did you get your PhD? And the guy was very evasive on the other side. He didn't really answer the question directly. And it took him more time to build trust and engage with this guy. Finally found out he was 19 years old. He was a high school dropout, and he was in Tijuana, Mexico. Who would have thought to look in Tijuana, Mexico among high school dropouts to find your CTO? He is now the CTO of his company, extraordinarily successful. And it illustrates one of the key principles of pull that we talk about in the book, which is the notion of serendipity and enhancing serendipity, shaping serendipity. And I think it's a great example. Systematic search, couldn't find anybody. Happened to be in a discussion forum. By choice, he was in that discussion forum. This person surfaced unexpectedly.
If I were a young person and I came to you, I said, I want to enter the business world and I'm trying to decide, would you recommend that I go for an MBA? I'm just trying to pin you down a little bit.
So. Oh, God. You're not going to let up, are you?
I won't tell you which school I got accepted to.
You know, and I have two daughters who are just graduating, finished college. And I have, from the first time they could really engage on these kinds of things, I just said one thing. I said, spend whatever time it takes to find your passion and follow that passion. Don't worry about your career. If you're passionate, you're going to be successful. I have actively counseled them to pursue their passion in workplace, in the broader workplace, before thinking about business school. And if they can convince themselves at some point in their development that business school would actually help accelerate their passion or intensify it or make them more successful, great. But don't just, I'm very concerned, too many young people that I see today are kind of going through, check the box. I got my undergraduate degree, I now got my business MBA degree or my law degree, and then I'm going to go get all the certificates I can, and then I'm going to game the career ladder. If you believe there is mounting pressure in the world around us, and I believe, barring a major movement back to a protectionist kind of regime, we will have mounting pressure. If you have mounting pressure, the only way you will succeed in mounting pressure is if you're passionate about what you're doing. Otherwise, you will quickly burn out, you will be marginalized, you will not be successful. And so I believe intensely that one of the key requirements for us as individuals is to figure out what our passion is and make the passion our profession. And I think that can be done in many different ways. But if you don't do that, all this other stuff about pull, the people who use pull most effectively are the ones who are really passionate. So.
John Nagel, thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.